Hello and welcome to everyone listening to the Written to Melanin podcast, the place where you come to get your weekly dose of melanated creativity. I'm your host, CM Lockhart, an author of fantasy books featuring Black girls who aren't all that nice and the owner of the Melanin Library, an online database of books written by Black authors. And in this space, I share with you everything I've learned on my journey as a Black and indie author. I'm glad you're here. Welcome to a special bonus episode of the Written to Melanin podcast, you guys. Today, I am here with Joelle Wellington, and she is a native of Brooklyn, New York, where her childhood was spent wandering the main branch of the Brooklyn Public Library. You would think I don't know how to talk, you guys. I'm so sorry. Her love of the written word led her to a BA in creative writing and international studies. When she isn't writing, she's reading, and when she's not doing that, she's attempting to bake bread with varying degrees of success or strengthening her encyclopedia-like pop culture knowledge. Welcome to the podcast, Joelle.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. I am so sorry for stumbling through all the R's in Brooklyn.
No, I get it. I like also stumble over my words constantly. It's like so bad. Like I always think that, so I have a, like I did theater and like growing up. And so I always think I'm like, oh, I'm articulate. I can like get through this. No, as you just saw, I stumbled through a very basic sentence just now trying to find my words. Like it's so bad. I do it all the time.
Oh, it's nice to know that it's not just me because
it's not.
Sometimes I'll have that same thought, like, oh, I'm so articulate. Like, I do this all the time. And then I'm like, huh? What?
Oh my gosh. Even writing, sometimes I skip letters when I'm writing too fast. Like, and I'm not looking at the keyboard and I'm just going. And then if I happen to like look up, like all the words, like none of the words will make sense. And I'll be like, what was I doing? Like, I can't even decipher that. Like, I don't know what that says. And that's always so frustrating when I'm like in the zone, I'm going, and then all of a sudden I'm like, this is not it.
No, like I feel that because my favorite thing is when I'll be typing and then all the letters will be wrong and I'll be like typing percentage signs and everything. And I realize, oh, my hands are off center on the keyboard. None of these words were about to make any sense.
None.
Okay, that being said, let's start at the beginning of this conversation because I want to make sure that our listeners know exactly who you are. So if you guys are listening to this and you have not heard the name Joelle Wellington, then I'm going to implore you to like dig deeper into the Black and Bookish community on literally any platform because she is the author of Their Vicious Games and it just came out. And let me tell you guys, it is so good. The way I ate this book up, oh my gosh, like, if I'm new to the horror thriller final girl genre, but I was locked in, like truly, I was just like, what is happening next? What is happening? What is going on? And I've talked about this on my YouTube channel. So if you haven't seen that video, definitely go watch it. But I literally had to stop my husband from, we read together on the couch. And so I had to stop him and be like, okay, look, I need to tell you what's happening because this, I need someone to understand what I'm going through right now. Because I made a sound and he looked up at me. He was like, are you okay? And I was like, no, I am not okay. And you need to not be okay either. So that being said, side rant aside, please, Joelle, in your own words, let our listeners know what Their Vicious Games is all about.
Yeah, so it's about a young Black girl named Adina Walker who has just graduated from high school. She graduated from a school called Edgewater Academy, and she has no prospects because she got into a physical fight with her former best friend. Her former best friend gets away scot-clean because she is wealthy and white, while Adina has nothing. And so to get back all of her college acceptances and her future, she enters a competition called The Finish, which is being sponsored by the founding family of Edgewater Academy. And she thinks it's like brain teasers and like tests and etiquette lessons. And then she finds out it is very much not that. It is a series of deadly games in which she has to fight against 12 other young women who already know what's happening while she is woefully unprepared.
Yes, and there's so much to the book that when I was reading it, I was just like, oh, I can appreciate this. Like, even the fact that, you know, the other girls were like, why are you here? Like, you really walked into this blind, huh? And Adina's really like, we're just going to be like schmoozing you guys. It's just networking. Like I can do that all day, every day in my sleep. And then they're, and then like literally the first thing they're like, is like, okay, you're going to need to ride a horse. And she's like, excuse me, I'm going to need to do what?
She's like, I can network. I know how to talk to these people. And they're like, we're not talking actually. Like, actually you will put yourself through physical hell. Yeah. That's what we're doing.
Yeah. It's going to be so fun. Gear up. Oh, okay. But that being said, let's kind of look at your book as a whole, because there's so many aspects to it that I just kind of want to pick your brain about. The first being like, what was the inspiration behind Edgewater Academy and the finish to begin with? Because not a lot of people are like, oh, you know what would be great? Let's do this academy that has a life or death battle at the end.
So I grew up in PWIs.
I feel like I know where this conversation's going.
Yes. So I've been in PWI since I was a sixth grader. And then all through college. And I just remember being like, I don't know. I felt like I was always in competition with literally everyone around me. Mm-hmm. And I was so unprepared. It just in the worst ways, and not academically, but like socially, I like was so lost for so long until like I learned how to play this game. And so I kind of like, I don't know, like when you're a kid growing up in that kind of environment, what you do is you like, you don't go to therapy, you stuff it down and pretend it didn't happen. Right.
Right.
And so, I graduated from college and it's the middle of the pandemic, and summer 2020 in America was crazy because that's when everything started really popping off. And so my high school had a, you know, remember those Instagram pages that people would make that would be black at insert white institution that did them wrong? Mm-hmm. My high school had one of those. Oh. And every post was about like something wild that had gone down at the school. But the thing was, is that I was like, in the moment of going to that school, I like was like, none of this is a big deal. This is just how it is. Reading all of this over again, I was like, what? Mm-hmm. What do you mean? Like, this is what I was going through?
Yep.
And so I just was like bewildered by this. Like, I was like, that's insane. Like, this is not how I like lived my life. But it was like every single story. I was like, I remember that, but it didn't seem that bad.
Right.
And now I'm like, okay, it was horrendous. And so, but at the same time, I was like, this is kind of funny, just a little bit. Like,
not you laughing like, at your own pain.
Exactly. It was like, just a little bit funny, just a tad. And so I was like, I want to write. And I remember tweeting this at random. I didn't even remember tweeting it. Somebody told me, they were like, I remember your thread when you first came up with this idea. And I was like, that's crazy. I don't. So I was like, what if I wrote about a young black girl going through this environment, but exaggerate it and make it camp and throw in The Bachelor? Because I think that that's fun. And I think it was like a really productive and cathartic way to process all of these things that I had refused to process for so long.
That makes sense, because when I was reading Adina's story, I'm not gonna lie, I'll be fully transparent. There are a couple things in the beginning I was like, ooh, girl, side eye, bombastic yes. Side eye.
She is really messy.
Yeah.
Really, like from the jump, like, I know that's, I remember when I was writing, I was like, this is going to put people off. But I was like, look, this is what she feels that she has to do. And I was like, you know, they always let white girl protagonists be really messy.
Yep.
My black girl protagonist can be messy too.
You delivered for sure. Because in the beginning I was like, and it's not even about being put off, because the thing that I really need to even finish a story, right? Because I, in case you don't know me, this is our first time interacting, obviously, but I am the queen of DNFing a book. And if I've...
Me too. I'm so sorry. If I'm not in it, there's too many good books in the world.
Right. If I'm not in it to win it, I am not going to make myself miserable trudging through a book. Because I'm like, I do this for fun. Like, this is, I'm not getting paid to do this. There's literally not enough time in the world for me to be this unhappy and upset while I'm doing something that I'm choosing to do for my own pleasure. But we're not talking about that part specifically. The point is, I will DNF a book so quickly. And one of the things that will make me put a book down is if I feel like the main character is like completely just doing things just for the sake of doing them. I'm like, they need to have reasons, like in-world reasons for doing what they're doing. And even though I didn't rock with most of Adina's decisions, especially in the beginning, I was just like, okay, but I understand where she's coming from and why she is playing the game the way that she is. Because at the end of the day, you know, a lot of times, especially as a Black woman in a predominantly white space, you kind of have to view it like, I have to play this game that they have set the rules for. And I completely understand it because, like, she's been playing this game for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. And she's like, I was finally about to win and now they're trying to, like, set me back? No, absolutely not. I'm not about this. So she's very driven, but also very like, ooh, girl, calm down. Because, like, part of me was also like, you could just go to HBCU with your friend. Like, that would also be an option.
Right? But and that's the whole thing. And there are so many other options, but then I always think about like going to my school. Like, my sister went to an HBCU. My little sister goes to Howard, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, and that is an option. But I remember when I was coming up, for some reason, that wasn't an option. Like, at my school, like, they just were like, they didn't bring it up at all. They were like, Ivy League or top 20. And I was like, what? And that was it. And it was so weird because I was like, this is how she would also be told. Like, there would be no college guidance counselors who were like, what about Hampton? What about Howard? Nope. No, they would have been like, girl, get your behind to an Ivy League or flop. Yeah. And that's a crazy thing to be told.
It is. And it's crazy because it's just like lived experience, right? Whenever I talk about like my experience, I realize that I am very much an anomaly because my entire family has gone to HBCU. So like growing up for me, going to an Ivy League was never on the table, like ever. Like, you better not go to one of those PWIs. You need to go to Hampton, Howard, A&T. You could go to A&T if you want. That's that's literally what the conversation was like. So it's always interesting to me when I find other people, you know, in the real world where it's just like that was not their experience. And, you know, I think about that because I was also very fortunate where I had kind of like the opposite experience of you. So like up until the 9th grade, I was in predominantly white spaces. And then 9th grade, I went to a Black high school and then I went on to an HBCU. So it was just, you know, kind of flipped. And it was just kind of like, huh. Interesting, because at my high school, it's like they were very much pushing HBCUs. And I was in the Academy for the Smart Kids. We're not going to get into that. But they were like, oh, do you want to go to like Harvard or like Yale? Like, you have the grades to get in. And I'm like, I don't know, you guys. Like, there are no Black people in these pictures. Okay. This makes me uncomfortable.
Okay, so I was also in a weird academy. Oh, it's called Prep for Prep. And see, I'm like whispering it because they're like so everywhere in New York. Mm-hmm. And so like they take you, and if I describe it, it's going to sound so bad. Okay. So when you're in elementary school, you get nominated by like your 5th grade teacher, right?
Okay.
And you go through IQ tests and all of these rounds of testing, and it's only inner city kids. And it goes from 14,000 kids being tested for one class to a contingent of like 120. And you go through 14 months of extra school. So like two days during this, it's like two summers where you'd be in class from like, I would say 9 to 4, Monday through Friday. And mind you, this is over the course of like fifth to sixth grade. And then during sixth grade, you would be in more classes, like extra classes in addition to regular school. And that would be like a weeknight and Saturdays. And then you'd have school again the next summer. And then you would be placed into the private school of your choice, and you would pay very little money. Right? And so like that's a great opportunity, very little money, but like to get there and the environment was just really like you will succeed. You better succeed. I still like remember like the motto and everything. And it's an elitist program. Like, that's what it is.
If y'all are listening to this podcast, because I feel like this is going to show up on YouTube, I feel like it has to. But if y'all are listening to this on the audio, I need you to know that my face is in absolute shock because I'm like, this is pure indoctrination. What?
Yeah.
Wait a second. So,
yeah. And so it's like, there's like a New Yorker article that a former alum wrote about it. And it's like, it's hard because like you're like, oh, this has like benefited me. Like, it has opened doors for me. Like, I didn't really have to pay for college. I didn't have to really pay for my, like, 6 or 7 years of my, like, schooling. Like, these are, like, amazing things. But it's also, like, huh? What about me that has made me better to deserve these things over other people, right?
Right.
And it's, like, they go with you forever. Like, this is, like, a forever thing. Like, oh. I am never, like... There are people there that I've never met, but they know me.
Oh.
Like, in the administration. Like, if I showed up to their headquarters, they would know me. They'd be like, we know exactly who you are. We know what contingent you are. We know exactly how old you are. Like, they know me. And so it's, like, stuff like that that's just so weird.
Man, where I'm like, this is... I'm gonna need you to go into witness protection.
Right? And so this is, like, all of these things, like, that I went through and this indoctrination... I like wanted to write about it. I was like, oh, I need to write about like this idea that people are better than other people and that like this black girl is better than others and just like all of this and like academic tension. I was like, I need to write a book about it. Like, I need to exercise all of this mess.
I could understand that. That is very layered. I was honestly, when I asked you the question, I was not expecting it to go that deep, but I understand 100% where you're coming from because that sounds wild, man. Mm-hmm. Like, and it's interesting because I feel like I'm gonna say this and I mean it in the best possible way, but it's a very specific lived experience for black children. And it's the idea of specifically black women being pitted against each other in the public eye is not new. And for most of us, it begins in elementary school, where there can mm-hmm. only be one of us that hangs with the cool kids. There can only be one of us that's accepted into certain groups and certain cliques and certain conversations. And it makes things a lot easier if you're the chosen one. But it's also like when you're the smart black kid and you're trying to, and your parents and your family are literally trying to make sure that you have opportunities and that they're not denied you because of circumstance or because of what you look like, a lot of times it becomes having to prove yourself to be quote unquote better, to prove that you are worthy mm-hmm. of the help and the success and the opportunities. And it kind of gets in your head, like you said, like, okay, but why am I getting this opportunity instead of making the opportunity available for everyone? Because you also know I'm not the only one who can do this. I'm not the only mm-hmm. smart one. And then it also feeds into this whole like gifted child syndrome, like when you get to an adult and you're like, okay, you're out in the world, go be productive, be a great citizen of society. And you're like, okay, I have literally had a chorus of people praising me for like the last 17 years. Where did that go? Where are y'all at?
So I remember graduating from college and like, yeah, I'm in the pandemic, but also I didn't know how to relax.
That part.
Like learning how to like be a full human being outside of my achievements, mm-hmm. like that took work. And I think about that constantly in terms of like the gifted black child. Like I'm like, oh, I didn't know how to be like a person outside of like these, like I didn't know what my hobbies were.
You don't have like, hobbies because
the first thing I tried to do with the hobby, I wrote a book. I made it my job. Like what?
It's like you have no chill. None. It's like everything becomes, and I wonder also how much of that is like society and like the whole hustle culture. Like if you enjoy mm-hmm. something, you obviously have to monetize. Like if you enjoy playing video games, oh, you should start a Twitch channel. Oh, you like reading? You should be on BookTube. Oh, you like knitting? You should start knitting like blankets and stuff to like sell. It's this idea that you have to monetize everything, but also when you have lived your life based off of your achievements, you feel like if you do something, you have to have something to prove. you have to have something mm-hmm. to show for it. It's not like you can just do it because you enjoy it. It's like, no, I have to, I can enjoy it, but I also have to be really good at it.
Exactly. And I think about this constantly.
Yeah. Sorry. I feel like we are scratching the surface of some very deep-seated trauma. So we are going to continue on. But that being said, I did want to touch on the book specifically, because obviously, if you've been listening to this, you know that there's a lot of levels that go into this story. But one of the things that you mentioned online is that your book is a satire, which, if you are like me, and sometimes you have to look up words that you hear all the time and don't necessarily know the definition of, satire is when you use humor or exaggeration to criticize people's stupidity or vices. So, that being what it is, you know, what was it that you were trying to criticize in this book specifically? Especially knowing,
yeah, right, the idea of like the isms, racism and classism. Like, I so purposely, like, I think that I really, really leaned hard into the dark humor of it all. Like, I wanted it to be like not just like traumatizing when you read the book, because there is tons. See, I would never call it traumatizing, but I know some people feel that the book is like a lot, right?
I can see it, but I also feel like it's not about trauma, if that makes sense.
Exactly. I don't think so either. I think a lot of people feel like it's a lot and that it's heavy. And I think that's fair, I guess. But at the same time, I really wanted to lean into the humor of it as catharsis. So I wanted to treat it as like a satire with the intent of catharsis at the end, where you're like looking at the classism and racism that Adina has faced throughout this entire situation. And almost laugh at some parts of it. Like, there's a part where she's given a gun and she goes, pew, pew. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, the way that teenage girls are raging at one another, I wanted to basically make fun of the idea. So, you know how people always say that girls would never do Lord of the Flies? They would never be in Lord of the Flies. Or they're like, women should run the world. Everything would be at peace.
No.
This is a joke about that.
No.
There is no. No.
Whoever says that has clearly never entered, one, a girl's bathroom in the middle of a high school day. And two, is like, you've clearly just never entered a lunchroom at any high school in America. Like, girls are the worst. Saying that as a girl.
Exactly. My whole thing, I'm like, but the thing is, I always think with teenage girls, because we're told to be polite and to control our emotions, and that if we're too emotional, we won't be taken seriously, teenage girls don't immediately hop to physical violence. They use psychological violence.
That part.
And I really wanted to push that with the satire, too. Like, the psychological violence of a card game of war.
Yeah.
Things like that. Like, I really wanted to push that and make fun of all of these themes and ideas in a way that also makes it easier to process. I also feel like there aren't that many satires in young adult novels, because I think it's like tough to like really do that on a level that a teenager would understand and feel related to. Mm-hmm. But I really feel like teenagers are really smart. And
way smarter than like people give credit for.
Exactly. And so I just was like, here are the themes that we are going to laugh at and make fun of and dissect together, while still really, really pushing a story first and foremost.
Mm-hmm. I really like that, especially the part where you mentioned the psychological warfare, because there is so much psychological warfare in this book, from Layton choosing to support Adina to literally any time Penthesilea, I think is how you say her name?
Penthesilea.
Penthesilea. I was never going to get that. But
no, no one ever does. I had a friend who texted me and she was like, all right. She was like, I'm only 45 pages in, but I'm going to need you to send me a voice memo of this girl's name. And I was like, yeah, I got it.
Penthesilea.
Here we go. Penthesilea.
Penthesilea. Penthesilea. I'm not going to remember that. But every time she shows up on the page, it's psychological warfare against everyone. And she does it so well, so effortlessly. And I feel like you definitely captured that aspect of being a teenage girl. I feel like going back to what you said earlier about how like some people say that the book is heavy, I will say this. If you're listening to this and you have not picked up Their Vicious Games, I will definitely say that there are some things where if you are triggered by racism, classism, then be mindful of that going into the book. But also, I will say this. There's a Django Unchained moment in the book?
Yes.
And I think it's worth getting to that moment. And if you are Black, you know exactly what that means, and I'm not going to elaborate further than that. But that being said, I think, you know, Joelle, you as an author, handle a lot of this as well as you can given the situations that the main character is in. And I also really liked Saint as a character, because Saint was just like,
I love her.
I'm in it to win it. And then as they're going, she's like, I am not in this to win it. And she's like, you know what? Nah, we got to go. Peace out. Not about this. But not here to just sing your praises. I also wanted to ask you about the pacing for the book, like as a whole, because it's okay. How would you classify it? Is it thriller, horror?
I would say it's a thriller, but the way I've paced it, I know it's a little strange. So I have like the very front chunk. It's a little slower than everything else. And I've done that purposely. Have you read Gone Girl? I'm sure you have. Everyone's read Gone Girl.
I've heard of it. You remember how we had that conversation at the beginning of this?
You're new. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Gone Girl. I have very purposely mimicked the structure and pacing of it in that. So Gone Girl, the whole of it is that the first part, do you mind spoilers?
Absolutely not. Have at it.
Okay. So the first part of Gone Girl, like Nick Dunn has discovered that his wife is gone. She's missing. There's blood everywhere. It's a really slow start. Like if you don't get into it because it's like a police investigation, which is not particularly fast paced. I would say you get about a quarter, maybe a third of the way in, and suddenly there's a blank page, and then you turn and it says Amy, and it's introducing her POV, and then all of a sudden you can blast through the rest of the book because it's this hinge where everything rests upon that, and then you just go. And that's what I wanted to mimic, because this is also one of my first thrillers that I've ever written. Even though this is a genre that I love, it's what I read probably, I would say, like, half of my reading are thrillers. And so I've never written it. So when I was, like, pacing it, I was like, this is the kind of structure that I was most familiar with. And then I found them personally the most interesting. I wanted to do, like, a slow burn start where you feel uneasy. You feel that something is wrong. Something is not right. And then you get to that hinge of the perfume. And then all hell breaks loose. And that's what I really, really wanted to work through. Which is why I know that it's also a book where it's kind of like the beginning does feel really slow in comparison to the rest of it. But that's also me thinking that you should be able to read thrillers in two sittings. And that's the slow part and then the everything else.
Well, I will definitely say that you accomplished that, because one of the things that I mentioned in my review is that like the first 100 pages, I was like, okay, I'm intrigued, but I'm also like, okay, I want to get to like, everything is not as it seems. I'm ready to get to this part. But then after that, like you said, once you get to that first real meeting and you get to the first death, and again, no spoilers for the book because I want y'all to go read it. But once you get to the first death, I was locked in for the rest of the night. Like I was up until like 4 a.m. reading the book, because I was just like, we're finishing this. Like, I don't care what else I had to do. So you accomplished exactly what you set out to do.
I'm so glad.
Yeah, it's really good. So again, if you guys are listening to this podcast and you have listened to my platform at all, you know that I am not a personal like advocate for books, because I want you guys to make your own decisions about them. I want you to like know about them, look into them, make your own decisions, because what I like may not be what you like. And also, I don't read enough books to make this a whole bookish podcast. It's about authors. So that being said, I have read this book. I enjoyed this book. I think if you like thrillers, Final Girl, Django Unchained, go read the book. Some of it is kind of heavy, but also I don't think it's too heavy if you have actually lived through any of the experiences included in the book, and you have started to like process them on any level. I think it'll just kind of add to the experience, because one of the things that I mentioned in my review is like, part of the reason the beginning, it doesn't feel slow inherently. It was just that for me, I understood from page one what Adina was going through and her frustration because I had lived in those spaces. So take that for what you will. But that being what it is, I also kind of want to talk about not just the book itself, but kind of like your experience with publishing it. Because as of today, I know if you're listening to this or you're watching this on YouTube, then obviously you're watching this from the future, right? But today is the 25th of August and your book came out in July. So your book has been out officially for a month today. How does that feel? Yes.
Oh, it's so weird. I just feel so overwhelmed. People are like reading it. It's so weird when I'm like scrolling on TikTok and I'm not on Book Talk per se, because sometimes I like see my friend's books and I'm like, oh, I don't need to hear what you have to say. But sometimes my book pops up on my own TikTok and then I'm like, you read it? And then I scroll past really fast because I don't want to know. I'm like, oh, I don't need to know your thoughts. It's okay. Because again, I think that readers are readers and I'm over here.
Yeah.
Being not a reader.
Being not a reader. So, I feel like that's a vibe. That's a mood.
Yeah. Being not a reader, y'all are over there and that's fine. But it's so weird and I feel constantly overwhelmed. I went on tour in the UK recently.
Oh, that's so cool. And congratulations.
That was crazy. Thank you. I went with Karen McManus, Marie Lu, and a UK-based author named Bea Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. And it was so, we went to five different cities and it was so weird because I was like, I'm a new author. My book has only just been out a few weeks. But then there'd be like teenagers who would come up to the signing line after our panels and be like, I already read your book. And I was like, oh, okay.
Devoured it.
I hope you liked it. So there was one girl who had like the UK version and also was like, wait, hold on, pulled out the US version. I was like, you paid for that to be shipped over here? Why?
Not the why.
It's the same book, I promise. We didn't even change spelling. Just weird. Bizarre to me that I'm a published author and I'm also like, well, I guess all I do now is write more books.
Yeah.
Because it's so weird because I had always been like, oh, I'm going to be an author when I grow up. From the age of four or five, I was like, I'm going to be an astronaut and an author. And then the astronaut dream died because you have to have 20/20 vision. God, the day I found that out, I was on the floor. I was in the trenches. So then I was like, well, I'm going to be an author. And so that was just my dream forever. And now I'm like, I'm 25, I've done it. And now I'm like, I guess I just have to keep writing books. Yeah. And that's an amazing position to be in where I'm like, oh my gosh, I just get to put more of my stories in the world and more people will read it. And it's just a wild thing.
I'm so excited for you. I'm excited for everyone who loves their craft and is living their dream. So I applaud you, ma'am. Your first book is great. I know your next book and everything else that you write is also going to be great. So I am sat here ready for it. Just need you to know that. But that being said, you are traditionally published. And
yes.
I do have listeners who come to this from both sides. So I'm indie, but also when I talk to chat authors, one of the things that I like to ask them is what their experience was like. Because, a lot of people, that's what they want. They kind of want to know what the process is. And one of the things that I like to do on the podcast, or try to do at least, is kind of go do away with some of the smoke and mirrors that surrounds publishing. Mm-hmm. So what was your experience like with that, from querying to agenting to the whole shebang?
Mm-hmm. So I, of course, everybody writes a book in high school and thinks it's brilliant and queries it and it's really embarrassing and it's bad. So of course I did that twice. But then of course it went nowhere. And then I got to college and I wrote a YA fantasy because that's what you think you have to do yep. to be in traditional publishing. You're like, oh, I gotta write a YA fantasy. And I love fantasy. Again, I don't really write YA that much. And especially not YA fantasy. And I remember like struggling through that. And I wrote that my junior year. And then May of my junior year, I started querying. And then by August, right before my senior year, I got two offers. Ooh. And I remember this very vividly, that I accepted the offer of my agent, Curisa Robinson, the first day of my senior year. I had just moved into my apartment with my roommates. Mm-hmm. And I saw it and I like screamed and ran up in circles in the living room. And mind you, there's boxes everywhere. And my roommates, who are two of my closest friends, they were very confused. Because they were like, we don't even know what you're doing. Like, what's an agent? Like, right. They were just like, what are you talking about? But they were like, yay, bought me a cupcake. Because you can't really buy anything as a poor college student. Like, we're like, nothing. Like, we're living on Kraft mac and cheese. And so I revised that YA fantasy with my agent and went on sub. And it flopped because it was bad. Like, I know that now, but in the moment I was like so devastated, because being on sub is like querying but 10 times worse, because you're not the primary communication person. Like, the editor is just going back to your agent, and then your agent is like, well, should I tell her? Does she want to know?
Gotcha.
And like, you can kind of schedule like how you get your rejection. So I know some people who are like, I want them as they come. And I know some people who are like, I want them once a month, and put them all together in a group. And I think that's, either way is like very valid. But unfortunately, I was a glutton for punishment. So I was like, tell me every single time somebody says, I hate you. And so periodically, I would just be scrolling through my email, and then boom, like somebody's like, nah. So we went through two rounds of that before I was like, you know what? I'm going to pull it. So then it was, the pandemic happened, and my agent was like, so do you have like another book? Like, what are you thinking? And I pitched another, again, a fantasy to her, which is crazy. And she was like, okay. And then I didn't write it.
She was like, I didn't write it.
I didn't write it. So instead, I pitch to my agent, and then we talk about it, and she's like, she tells me whether or not she's like, she thinks she can sell it, and if I care if she can sell it, because sometimes she's like, if you feel really passionate, just write it and we can figure it out. And I'm like, all right, cool. And so this project, Their Vicious Games, which it wasn't called that originally, it's called Bloodsport. But yeah, we had to change it for SEO purposes.
That's fair.
It is fair. But I also work in copywriting, and so I was like, ugh, I guess. And so I came up with this idea, and I just started writing it, and I kind of told my agent when I was halfway through, and I was like, all right, this is what I've been working on. I know you don't really represent thrillers. That's another thing. I was just writing in a genre she doesn't represent. I was like, do you love me? Like, and she was just like, yes. So write it. And I was like, thank you. And so, I just like wrote it, and we went over it a couple times. We went through like, I think, two rounds of revision, and then so the thing about trad publishing is that nothing happens in the summer. And so, because there's summer Fridays and everyone's on vacation. And so I remember finishing it around June, and she was like, we're not going out till September. And I was so impatient. I was like, no, what if we went out? She was like, no, we're not going out till September. And so we sat on it for a couple months, and then we went out in September. And I thought it was going to be very much of a repeat of what happened last time, but it was not, because we sent it out, and then 2 days later, we got, like, somebody was like, we want to hop on a call. And I was like, oh, okay. And then about an hour later, she was like, somebody else wants a call. And so we ended up going to auction with it, with about, I think, eight publishing houses.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, and it was really fantastic. Like, I was just like overwhelmed. It was just, it eventually became like all of these houses like courting me instead of me begging them to publish me. And I eventually went with my publisher, Simon & Schuster, because they, I remember this so vividly. Like, I would recount how I came up with this idea to the editors. And a lot of them were white editors. And some of them were like, oh, we want to like camp it up. And I was like, I don't really love that. Like, I think it's campy as it is. Like, I think it's fine as it is. And then other people were just didn't really share the same vision for me. But then I met my editor. She was the very last person I spoke to. She's a white woman. She had Simon & Schuster. And I remember telling her about like my background and like the my schooling environment, all of this stuff. And she didn't like apologize to me. You know how like when white people are like, oh, I'm so sorry. Mm-hmm. That's not what she said. Instead, she was like, oh, that sucks. I'm sorry that happened to you. And I just was like, I bust out laughing. And I thought that that was the best thing I'd ever heard.
It's like, because, it's not guilt. It's just like, oh, that's a thing.
Yeah, she was like, that sucks. Like, and I was like, that was like, I just, it was so refreshing to me because I've heard so much of, and I remember this is the summer, like, this is like right around the time where every, like,
2020,
people, I think, were feeling really, really, this is 2021, but white people are still feeling really, really apologetic.
Yeah.
And like, we're being like, we're like tiptoeing. And she just did not do that. She was just like, yeah. And then she would, I remember this again, she was like, this is your book. And I'm going to help you make it better, but also you're the expert. So I'm not going to step on any toes. And I appreciated that because I read about like blackness and black girls. And she's a white woman. And so she's like, you're the expert on that. Like, she's like, I got to help you make the book like structure better. And she was like, but you know what you read about. Like, and I trust that. And I love that because she was not trying to change anything. Like, in terms of content, she was really, really focused, and not in terms of character either. Like, she never, like, it was never that. She was like, how do I make this more tense? Like, mm-hmm. structure. And I just really appreciated that. Like, and I was like, oh, yeah. And then they also have, like, black authors that I really respect and that they mentioned. And I remember when they pitched to me during, like, the auction, they were like, okay, like, we here are things we want to do specifically to get your book to black readers. Mm-hmm. And that spoke volumes to me because I was like, oh, so you know my audience.
Yeah.
That's nice. And they like followed through on that. Like, I remember when we first started sending out ARCs, they sent out ARCs to primarily black bookstagrammers and black book influencers. And they sent in all these fancy boxes and we did like book clubs with them. And it was just really nice. And I really appreciated that.
Like, it sounds like you had a really good experience, and I'm really mm-hmm. grateful to hear that side of it because, I mean, you...
And I have a lot of friends who didn't have great experiences.
Yeah.
And so, and I always talk about that with them, and they're always like, I am so glad that you did not get this the way I was treated. And I think it would be so easy for people to resent it, and I would understand it so fully if they were like, oh, you didn't experience what I experienced, and that bothers me, because that would bother me too. Like, I'm human and I know that, but I feel like I personally have like a community around me of black authors who are just so kind and really like are rooting for me, and I love that so much because I think in an industry where it really pushes there can only be one, there is a black community of authors who are very, very much pushing against that in trad publishing.
And I love that because I personally fully reject that whole idea of there can only be one. I've always mm-hmm. rejected it. And I've said it before, I will say it again. There is more than enough room at this table for everyone to eat. So I am always glad to hear positive experiences because I know that, you know, there are so many people, especially black authors, who want to know the truth about what publishing is like. And, you know, there's this reality that it's up in the air. It depends on you. It depends on the person that you meet. It depends on your circumstances. It depends on the type of editor you get and, mm-hmm. you know, what your publishing house is willing to do for you and what they're willing to listen to and so on and so forth. Like, so many of it is like variables that you don't necessarily have control over. So it's really nice to hear your experience and also mm-hmm. the part about your editor, because whether you are traditionally published, indie published, whatever, when you have an editor who says exactly what, you know, what you were telling us is that, you know, I'm here to help you enhance your story. I am not here to change it. I'm not here to take it over. I'm not here to morph it into something that it is not. I think that is super, super important, especially as like a creative. It's like you wrote your book the way that you did for a reason. So when it comes to things like, oh, what if this character had a completely different personality? It's like, well, no, that's not really up for debate. And so I personally prefer an editor who focuses on structure and pacing and things that are like technical, because for a lot of authors, in my general experience, speaking very broadly here, right, a lot of authors they've got the creative part in spades. They can make up the story. Like, they don't need help with that part. Mm-hmm. They need help with making the story cohesive into something, into a product, you know? And I love a good editor, and I can appreciate when someone has a good editor. So I'm excited for you. I'm excited for this book. I'm excited for more people to read it. I'm excited for everything else that you were going to write and to share, which kind of brings me to my next question, which is, you know, what's up next for you? Like, is there anything that you can share?
I can share a little bit. So this is the next book that I'm working on is a meta horror comedy. Ooh. And it's very much inspired by Scream and The Cabin in the Woods and Final Destination.
Okay.
And it takes place in Brooklyn, because this is my love letter to Brooklyn and growing up there. And it's about a group of Black and brown kids. And I won't say past that, but it's kind of like looking at horror as a genre, and it's not so much a horror. I don't know if that makes sense, but it gets very, very meta. And I think it's really camp and tongue-in-cheek. And I'm working on my revisions for it now, and I'm having so much fun.
Yay.
Like, first of all, drafting a book on contract is awful. I've never experienced anything like that. Like, I had an eye twitch.
Like, literally everyone I have ever spoken to has said that. Like, oh my god, writing. It's like, it's so exciting. It's always like, oh, it was so exciting getting my first book deal, and I was thrilled, and then I had to write another book, and I hated it.
Oh god, I've never experienced. And I used to tell people, I was like, oh, I know what I'm going to do, because I had the idea from when I first sold the book, and I was like, oh, I won't have sophomore book syndrome. A lie. I was
everyone
dying.
Does.
Yeah, every single time she'd be like, is it done? And I'd be like, I need 3 more weeks. Like, and she'd be like, okay. And I'd be dying inside. Like, I've never experienced, and by the end, I gave up. Like, act 3 is a mess, because I was like, here you go.
Throwing in the towel.
And I sent it to my editor. I was like, I'm so sorry about act 3. I know it's a mess. But that is what it is.
She's like, this is what I got.
I was like, I can't do anything about it. Like, I'm done. And she was like, that's fine. We'll work on it. But I've never felt anything like that in my entire life. Like, by the end, I was like, I loved this idea, but I hate this book. But rereading it and working on it now, like revising, I'm like, oh, I love you again. You're my child. But also, I'm like, I'm never gonna forget that like icky feeling of writing that book while on contract. Like, that was something else.
I believe it, because my next book, We Are Dying Gods, comes out next week, and I picked a release date before I had written the book, and I had announced it, and I was just like, okay, yeah, I got this. I'm so good. And you know what? By the end of it, I was like, I am never doing this again. So now when people ask me,
that's wild that you announced it before finishing it. That's crazy.
I literally did not even have the first chapter. I was just like, I know what happens, but I did not have a title. I did not have a chapter. I just knew what was going to happen in the book as a general idea.
I've never experienced anything like that.
That's fine.
And the fact that it would make me actually nauseous if I had done what you did. I have a date set. Oh my gosh. And mind you, I was like ill through the first draft, but I would quite literally vomit. Like, what?
Literally, the only reason I did it is because my co-host for my talk show was like, oh, my birthday is on that day and you should just release the book on my birthday. And I was like, okay, this is your birthday present. Don't ask me for anything ever again. And so I did it. But now that it's coming out, my husband is like, okay, well, next year, my birthday. And I'm like, no, I am never, ever doing this again. The way I had to pull so many all-nighters, and you said the eye twitch, I literally had one too. Trying to like write it
Just like a little boop, boop, constantly. I'd go into my day job and my coworkers would be like, you look so tired. Are you okay? And I'd be like, girl, no. Mind you, I go into my day job 2 times a week, maybe, because it's like hybrid. The fact that I was still tired, like, I'm not even leaving my house. Like, I'm just in my house. I didn't see friends for weeks because I was like, I can't, I'm behind. Like, and they'd be like, okay, terrible vibes.
That's real. And they'll be like, oh, like, how's your book going? Don't ask me about that. Literally ask me about anything else.
Yeah, and now I'm on deadline again. And my editor was like, how are we feeling about September 20th? No, actually. How about October 2nd? Give me 10 extra days.
She said move this back.
Actually, yeah, what? And I didn't even realize. I was talking to one of my friends the other day where I was telling them, I was like, yeah, I have my edit letter, which is about, I was like, oh, it's short this time. It's only 17 pages. And then, oh, my first one for The Vicious Games was 30 pages long. I've never felt such like sadness.
I was so dead. She said, it's nice and short. It's only 17 pages. I would cry if I got an edit letter that long.
No, exactly. I was like, it's only 17 pages. My editor is so thorough. Like, I'd be like, whoa. And half of it is questions. It's like, and I'm like, oh. Because that's the kind of, like, author. I love a question.
Yes.
To make me think and really dig deeper. But I'm like, there's a lot of questions. But I was telling my friend, I was like, yeah, it's only 17 pages. And the line edits are all there, so I'm accepting the track changes. And they were like, you have both? Why do you have line edits and an edit letter? And I'm, is it, what, which round are you on? I'm like, developmental. They're like, why do you have both? I'm like, I don't know. And now I'm learning that my editor does 2 rounds in 1. And I'm like, you're so sick. Why would you do that?
As someone who does freelance editing from time to time, I can say that from my experience, it's a lot easier because you see the line edits while you're doing the developmental. And it's just like,
that's fair.
By the way, I think you skipped this word here. I think that you meant to say that this is going to start, not state. Just going to throw that out there, you know? But that being said, like, thank you so much for just sharing everything. Like, this has been such an eye-opening conversation, and I appreciate
you so much. Thank you for having me. Yeah. Thank you for having me.
So, I have one more question for you, and then I'm going to go ahead and wrap us up. And this is the question that I ask everyone who comes on the podcast, and that is, what writing advice would you give to any new authors just now starting out on their writing journey?
Read. And I would say read books, read everything. Books that make you uncomfortable, books that are in your comfort zone, because I think it helps you figure out the kind of storyteller that you want to be. I didn't realize that I wanted to write thrillers and murder mysteries, even though that's most of what I read. And so, like, that's so informative to me now that I, like, really pay attention to that. I'm like, oh, that's what I love. That's what I like to write about. But then it also tells me, like, if I read a book that I don't love, I'm like, well, I don't want to write about that. Like, so I think it's really helpful in figuring out the kind of storyteller you want to be, because then you also see authors that you really respect and you find out things, you recognize things in their craft that you're like, oh, I want to implement that in my own work and that kind of thing.
I love that, because it's very important to, like, inform your creativity, inform your decisions, because, you know, everyone doesn't write everything, and that's okay. And just because you have the capability to write something doesn't mean that you want to write something. Mm-hmm. So read until you find the spark that fuels your creative flame. There we go. Ooh, look at me. All right. That being said, you guys, that is it for this episode of the Written and Melanin podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, then please share it with someone you think may enjoy it. Join my Patreon at patreon.com/CM Lockhart or grab a copy of my books, We Are the Origin and We Are Dying Gods, from my website, cmlockhart.com. If you'd like to support Joelle, then please purchase her books and follow her on social media. There are links in the show notes for everything. And thank you guys again so much for listening. Until next time, I hope all your books are full of melanin.